don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. A dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. And there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
The Oscar-winning star of Network, Peter Finch, giving his legendary speech as TV news anchor Howard Beale. Politics, media, and the movies. That's today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
The reality of politics versus the way that I'd studied them turned out to be two very different things, and I couldn't rectify that difference anymore.
Lead for this director, Ben Younger, recalls his years as a political campaign manager and the event that prompted his major career switch into filmmaking. We'll also look at efforts to bypass a cost-cutting government and crowdsource the preservation of a much-loved classic film. And a little later...
To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish.
If this strange new world has left you feeling mad as hell, we'll take a look back at some films that should help soothe your angst. That's all coming up today on The Cinema Show, here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. The worlds of politics, media, and the movies overlap more than we might think. We'll take a closer look at that later in the show. But first, director Ben Younger started his career in a rather unlikely place. While studying political science at university, he started dabbling in stand-up comedy. He soon found his way into the world of politics and eventually became New York's youngest campaign manager after his successful role managing the election of Queens Democrat Melinda Katz. But then a tragic event had such a profound impact on him, it caused him to question his entire career's direction. Today, Ben Younger is an established filmmaker. His new film, Bleed for This, tells the true story of a boxer who, even after breaking his neck, still climbs back into the ring. I spoke to him recently here in London, where I started by asking about his early political work.
I had a full-on career as a policy analyst. The part that sticks out is the campaign manager. But really, I was working as a policy analyst for the New York City Comptroller's Office. I took a sabbatical from that job to run the campaign of Melinda Katz.
Which was a very successful campaign.
In some ways, in the sense that she won, it was very successful, but the collateral damage was off the charts. My boss's wife slit her wrists in a bathtub because the challenger that we were going up against made his campaign made allegations that my candidate was involved with an extramarital affair with my boss from the comptroller's office, which was not true. His wife had back surgery and she was on a lot of medications, and she didn't kill herself, thank God. But that's when I was like, I got to get out of here. This is too dirty.
So that brush with the absolute depths of what could be described as just misery, how did that impact you in a personal sense?
My initial interest in politics was very theoretical. I was a big fan of, you know, Madison and Jay, the Federalist Papers, Rousseau, de Tocqueville. I really thought you could make change, affect change that way through that system. And the American system is great, but it's not great anymore. They've sort of just manipulated it to, you know, lobbyists have manipulated it to a point where all those great pieces of paper don't really, they don't protect people in the way that they used to. The reality of politics versus the way that I'd studied them turned out to be two very different things, and I couldn't rectify that difference anymore.
Tell me a little bit about how you had established yourself as a comedian. Was that something that was always playing a strong role in your life, even while you were working in politics?
That was prior to politics. I did stand up when I was last year of high school, 17, and then into college. Humor was a huge part of my life, the household I grew up in. I mean, Boiler Room and Believers are both dramas that have a lot of comedy in them. I can't sort of stay away from trying to get a laugh. It also just, I think it highlights the drama in both the drama and the comedy when you have a sort of a well-earned laugh in a space that's not comedic. Tragedy plus time equals comedy. My grandmother said to me once, looks fade, funny lasts forever. And that's my mantra.
So tell me about that moment that you decided to step away from politics and walk into filmmaking as, well, hopefully as a legitimate profession. Did you feel as though you were letting go of something that you'd held precious for quite a long time?
That's probably the most personal, you probably didn't know it, the most personal question you could ask me. And I've never been asked it. And the reason is that, you know, I grew up in a very traditional Orthodox Jewish home. And the arts, there was no emphasis put on the arts. It wasn't even like looked down upon, you just didn't do that. You know, you earned a degree, you got yourself a profession, you put your head down and you stayed out of the gas chamber. That was literally the thought process. So there's a word in Yiddish called narishkeit, it means nonsense. That's what my grandfather told me when I told him I was going to quit my job. But the way I was able to do it, to escape that sort of upbringing, was my father died when I was 19. He was an accountant, hated his job, never wanted to do that. And his death sort of allowed me to quit that job. And even my mother, who I never thought would sort of have approved, when I spoke to her one day at the controller's office from my cubicle, and she said, what's wrong? I said, I hate this job, I'm miserable. And she actually said, so quit, which is, that's a big deal for someone from that background. But it was a gift, because that really allowed me to just to pick up and leave.
Tell me about Bleed for This then. It's based on the true story of a boxer who broke his neck and then climbed back into the ring to continue boxing. Now, I am going to be open and honest and say I am not a sports aficionado. And from the outset, I look at that story just purely in isolation and I say, wow, what an idiot. Why would he do that?
We didn't have dissimilar reactions, you and I. I guess I was enamored with the fact that someone would choose a passion in their life over walking or would risk paralysis. The doctor told him, you're insane. There's a really good shot you don't ever walk again. The idea that he would choose something in his life over the possibility of ever walking again, I just thought that was incredible. Because I thought, if someone told you could give up filmmaking but you could walk, I would choose walking, and then I would go paint houses and I'd sort the rest out afterwards. A lot of things I like to do in this world, but I don't care enough about filmmaking where I would risk paralysis. No way. So I thought somebody who went to that extreme was a good example for the rest of us who have lesser choices to make. But, you know, that's what you want out of film. You want something that's so stark, the contrast, that it helps you, it puts into relief your own decision-making and maybe your own dilemmas or problems that you're facing. And that's why I think why boxing films endure. It's such like a obvious, in a good way, a really obvious, accessible paradigm for difficulties we all face.
Now go out there and show me how you do things. Show me how you live. Show me how you fight.
A clip from Bleed for This, capping off my interview with Ben Younger. He both wrote and directed the film, which stars Miles Teller as a real-life boxing champion, Vinny Pazienza. It's out in UK cinemas on the 2nd of December. Now, have you ever wondered when films became so vulgar? Well, it's perhaps a gripe often relegated to the older generation, and devotees to a kind of cinema not often seen in today's multiplexes. But I must admit, when I saw a poster affixed to a big red bus here in London advertising the new film Bad Santa 2, I couldn't help but wince. It was almost like clockwork then when another chapter from the memoirs of an anonymous film critic arrived on the Cinema Show's desk this week. This time, our unhappy friend muses over the modern decline of cinematic standards.
Memoirs of a Disgruntled Critic, Chapter 5. What is an erotic film? These days, I fear the answer comes all too readily. It is a film full of bared flesh and unseemly vulgarisms, the screen awash with the explicit exchange of unmentionable bodily fluids and medically inadvisable combinations of human anatomy and popular commercial brands of power tool. That, it seems, is what passes for arousing nowadays. Oh, how I mourn the loss of true sensuality in film. I always said that Alfred Hitchcock could generate more raw sexual energy with a single dolly zoom than Halle Berry ever could, even if she had 1,000 breasts. The old masters understood eroticism, you see. They knew that there is simply nothing sexier than subtlety. I think of the famous scene in Duck Soup, when Groucho and Harpo Marx mimic each other's movements through a broken mirror. To the jaded 21st century viewer, I'm sure it looks very quaint, but to a mind yet to be scrambled by the endless genital parade of latter-day Hollywood, it is a masterpiece of slow-burn seduction. Director Leo McCarey had the sensitivity to let the scene breathe, to allow the flame of longing between Marxes to burgeon gradually, yet glow all the brighter for it. I'm fairly sure Ms. Catherine Bigelow would never have the patience to let the timeless dance of human intimacy play out so naturally. Yet ask any child of the 1930s about the most erotic image they can conceive of. I guarantee they will name Groucho in that modest yet slyly sinful nightgown, spelling out forbidden love in the alphabet of the human body. When I saw it in the cinema, I learned for the first time the meaning of the word tumescent. An usherette told me, but the declining educational standards among cinema staff is a subject for another day. Just when did we lose the willingness to leave things to the imagination? The great filmmakers of yore made you work for your stimulation, and it was all the more satisfying for it. When we have Leonardo DiCaprio and Margot Robbie's relentless thwacking served up to us on a silver salver, it robs us of the exquisite joy that comes from watching The Adventures of Robin Hood and constructing a vision of Olivia de Havilland reverse cowgirling on Errol Flynn from the ground up in our own heads. You could even throw Claude Rains in there if you felt like it. And it was truly exciting, because we all know that the fantasy you create yourself is the one you truly value. Alas, those days are gone forever. We are left with only the sledgehammer of full frontal nudity and the stale comfort of Angela Lansbury on VHS.
Another chapter from the memoirs of our esteemed film critic friend. Still to come on The Cinema Show, we'll learn how crowdfunding helped ensure the preservation of a much-loved classic film. And if the last week of politics has left you feeling frustrated, well, get ready to let off some steam.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called MUBI.
Sometimes Wells' films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, MUBI adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
You're back with The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. When governments have to find savings, it's often the arts on the chopping block. And that's certainly the case in Australia. Over the last few years, national cultural institutions like the National Film and Sound Archive have had to have some serious cuts. To continue their job of preserving Australia's audiovisual heritage, the archive has turned to crowdfunding. In a kind of pilot project, they chose to crowdfund the restoration of the 1991 film Proof, which stars the fresh-faced Russell Crowe and Hugo Weaving. James Viver went to find out more.
Proof. Sometimes it takes the darkness to see the light.
Proof is about Martin, a blind photographer played by Hugo Weaving. Celia, Genevieve Pico, is Martin's housekeeper, while Andy, Russell Crowe, acts as Martin's eyes, describing the everyday life around them, like this scene at the cinema.
She's at the window again. She hasn't even seen him.
What, is she blind?
Ah, just stupid.
It's really an intriguing exploration of one man's lack of trust in the world.
Film critic and National Film and Sound Archive ambassador, Margaret Pomerantz.
I think it shows an extraordinary talent in this film that explores trust. It's such a unique film in its way. It has extraordinary performances from Russell Crowe. And this is before Romper Stomper. He is just unbelievably good. And of course, Hugo Weaving, one of our most respected stage actors, you know, embracing screen.
Would you like to come in? For some tea? Or some port?
Yeah, I would.
I don't think this film could, even though it's about a man, I don't think it could have been made or written by a man. I think it is a very feminine perspective on jealousy, love, trust, life.
Why don't you tell me where we are?
It's a surprise. You'll love it. You'll wish you'd brought your camera with you. Then you could have taken a photograph and shown it to your little friend, the one who describes things to you.
You leave Andy out of this.
As a piece of cinema, Proof certainly has the artistic credibility. But why crowdfund the restoration of a film from the 1990s?
Theatrical audiences wouldn't have been able to see this film at least for the last 6 or 7 years.
National Film and Sound Archive director Michael Lobenstein.
There is hardly any cinemas in Australia that can play 35mm film anymore, and there is no new digital elements for any of that. So in a way, a film from 1991 is less accessible than some of the cinema from the 1950s or 60s that has been reissued on TV, that is available on Blu-ray or whatsoever. Also, colour film stock is prone, and the magnetic audio tape, I must add, that the soundtracks are recorded on are prone to obsolescence too. Colours start fading, magnetic tape starts shedding its contents.
So, frame by frame, Proof was digitally restored to the way it looked when it was first shot. And it looks great. The colours are brighter, the light and shade are better defined, and the audio is clearer. And, better still, the whole project was paid for with money raised from the archive's crowdfunding campaign.
We managed to raise $26,000, which is amazing, and which is fantastic money compared to the total running costs of the National Film and Sound Archive. Of course, this is water drops on burning rocks. And it can never be an alternative to taxpayer-funded, publicly subsidized cultural organizations. However, more important than the $26,000 cash that came in is the 266 people who believed that it was worthwhile putting anything from $2 up to $5,000 behind this, because they actually believe that they want to be not only part of a crowdfunding campaign, but that they can actually own this, that this is part of their history and that they are instrumental in bringing it back to life. So apart from financial necessities, crowdfunding really is an instrument to galvanize people's support and people's passion for cultural heritage and for their cultural and arts organizations.
All in all, the campaign was a success, and Michael says they'll consider crowdfunding again.
I'm interested in thinking out and trialing some other crowdfunding models too. For instance, would it work to crowdfund for something that is completely unknown at a smaller scale, for instance? Could we crowdfund for digitizing newsreels by basically saying, look, 1 foot of film is going to set you back $5. Yeah, if you want to preserve 1 foot of film of the newsreel from the week of your birth, $5 buys you a foot, $2,000 buys you the whole reel.
If we don't preserve our film history, even our recent films, they're going to fade and die. In a perfect world, I would like every single film that we have ever produced to be restored and maintained by the NFSA.
Thanks, James. Now, if you're anything like me, you've probably found it rather difficult to adjust to this strange new political reality that's just been thrust upon us. Well, let me guide you through a few films that ought to help you let off some steam.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
They knew he wasn't mentally fit for the job, but that didn't stop media executives from ensuring those cameras kept on rolling. Even when his ranting ventured beyond the offensive and entered the realm of madness, ratings were only going up. Why stop now? If you think that sounds familiar, well, you're not alone. In the years since director Sidney Lumet's dark satire of the television news industry premiered in 1976, critics have often remarked at how Network feels like a frighteningly accurate prophecy. In his review of the film, Roger Ebert wrote that when they doubt that a Howard Beale could get on the air, but we have no doubt that the idea would be discussed. A sign perhaps of how far our reality has progressed beyond the almost quaint satire presented here. The worlds of politics, media, and the movies overlap more than we might think. From the dreamlike utopia of Oz, which at first greets us like a vision of perfection before its true colours are revealed, to Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, and its more grounded but little seen cousin, Failsafe. The introduction of a political dialogue into a film is often deafeningly loud, but sometimes it's done with such subtle finesse, it can be easy to miss.
In 1968, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, it became the classic horror film of its time.
Not that room! Not that room!
Now, George Romero brings us the most intensely shocking motion picture experience for all times.
It gets up and kills. The people it kills get up and kill. This station must be controlled before it's too late. They are multiplying too rapidly.
Dawn of the Dead.
Audiences of the late 70s might have been forgiven for glancing over the allegory at play in a horror movie about a group of people facing a hungry swarm of zombies at a shopping mall. Many of the scenes in Dawn of the Dead aren't too much of a stretch from a Black Friday sale.
The war in Korea was over. Captain, now Major Bennett Marco, had been reassigned to Army Intel in Washington. It was, by and large, a pleasant assignment, except for one thing. Night after night, the Major was plagued by the same reoccurring nightmare.
In 1962's The Manchurian Candidate, a team of American troops is captured by Chinese communists during the Korean War. Early in the movie, we're shown the process by which the men can be hypnotized and brainwashed, turning them into virtual slaves and, in one case, a would-be assassin with his eye set on a presidential candidate. A year after the film hit American theaters, President John F. Kennedy was killed in Dallas. And while the mind control depicted in the film is purely the work of fiction, it didn't stop the film's influence from coalescing with suspicions surrounding Kennedy's killer, Lee Harvey Oswald. When the movies tackle politics, they tend to reflect the sentiment of the time. Coming so soon after Senator Joseph McCarthy's infamous crusade against so-called communists, the bleak satire rippling through The Manchurian Candidate seems quite fitting. In a most pointed jab, one scene involves a character who is being questioned over how many communists he thinks might be in the State Department. After staring blankly at a ketchup bottle, he finally answers, 57. That same year, another political movie tackled McCarthyism, albeit with a slightly more refrained tone.
I believe Mr. Robert A. Leffen will lead us straight to perdition.
Come on, Steve, we know what's eating you.
Leffingwell made a liar out of you in a hearing 5 years ago.
It's a long time to carry a grudge, Zeb.
Maybe for a young fellow like you. My table of time, it happened just like yesterday. Stay gentlemen.
Advise and Consent features Henry Fonda as a controversial pick for Secretary of State. Much of the film focuses on the swarm of infighting and name-smearing taking place behind the white walls of Washington, an eruption of vitriol not entirely removed from the reaction to the suggestion of Barack Obama for president. Most astonishing, however, is the appearance of a closeted gay character, something which, judging by the reviews of the time, clearly put the film a little too far ahead of itself. When it comes to political satire, however, there's perhaps no greater and certainly no braver example than Charlie Chaplin's first talking picture, The Great Dictator.
I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. To live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. This world, there's room for everyone.
Released in 1940, the film focuses on a Jewish barber with a remarkable resemblance to Adolf Hitler, who is somehow mistaken for the dictator himself. Even today, satirizing Hitler can be a touchy subject, but in the late 1930s, he wasn't yet universally seen as the icon of evil that we now know, making Chaplin's lampoon all the more remarkable. The film is most powerful when it's using Chaplin's brilliant comedic talents to reduce Hitler to a ridiculous joke. But late in the film, Chaplin breaks away from his character and delivers a monologue to the camera, a wondrous, passionate illustration of the moral cause underpinning the film. Many critics felt that turned an otherwise sharp satire into a lecture, but Chaplin refused to cut it. Watching Chaplin implore his audience in today's context, it's hard not to feel the weight of his words.
Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
And that's it for today. The Cinema Show was edited by Claire Crofton and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. And we leave you this week with a track from the classic 1936 film version of the musical Showboat, which took the very bold step of blending Broadway extravagance with serious racial issues. Here's the actor Paul Robeson performing Old Man River. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.
Scared.